name's Nick Sawyer, and welcome to the Swap Podcast, where we exchange news and views on the latest trends in derivatives and finance. The US Treasury market is the deepest and most liquid government bond market in the world and acts as a cornerstone of global financial markets, including derivatives. So it's pretty important that this market continues to function efficiently, even during times of stress. Now, that hasn't always been the case, and there have been a couple of instances in recent years when the Treasury market showed signs of real dysfunction. For example, during the Dash for Cash in March 2020. Not surprisingly, this has been a big focus for regulators, market participants, and academics, and serious thought has gone into how to make this market more efficient, competitive, and resilient. As part of that effort, the US Securities and Exchange Commission adopted rules last December that will require increased clearing of certain cash US Treasury securities and repo transactions. Those requirements will come into effect in two stages: cash transactions from December 31st, 2025, followed by repos from June 30th, 2026. Now, we've talked to market participants about the resilience of the Treasury market, most recently Frank LaSala from DTCC in episode 34. We've also had the perspective of an academic, Daryl Duffy, in episode 38. So, you've guessed it, it's time to hear from a regulator, and we're going to be speaking with someone who's immersed in the minutiae of markets, Michelle Neal, head of the Markets Group and a member of the Executive Committee at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. ISDA's CEO, Scott Amalia, is here with me. Scott, we've looked at the Treasury market resilience, Treasury market clearing from a number of different angles, so it's great to round this out with the perspective of the New York Fed.
Absolutely. Michelle's had a huge amount of experience in financial markets. First, as a market participant, working in senior roles at RBC Capital Markets, BNY Mellon, and Deutsche Bank, among others, before moving to the New York Fed. So I'm looking forward to getting her perspective.
And do you want to elaborate on what you'd be talking to her about?
Sure, you've largely covered it in your intro, but I'd like to get Michelle's views on the steps that have been taken to improve the resilience of the Treasury market and potential gaps and challenges. We'll obviously touch on the SEC's Treasury clearing rules and the impact that will have, but I'm also keen to talk about the extent in which bank balance sheet capacity constraints have contributed to the problem. This is something we discussed with Daryl Duffy a few episodes back.
Scott, it almost sounds as if there's a structure and a plan to all these episodes. So, sounds great. Let's bring Michelle on.
Michelle, thanks so much for joining us on The Swap. It's great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott. Before I begin, I'd just like to note that the views I express today are my own and not necessarily those of the New York Fed or the Federal Reserve System.
All right, let's get into it. The U.S. Treasury market is the deepest and most liquid government bond market in the world and keeps the wheels of the global economy turning. Nonetheless, this market has come under severe stress on several occasions in recent years, notably the Dash for Cash in March of 2020. How would you assess the Treasury market liquidity and resilience since then?
Well, you know, following the Dash for Cash in 2020, Treasury market liquidity has improved and held up very well in 2023, despite some challenging conditions for rates markets, including some heightened uncertainty and stress surrounding the regional bank failures just over a year ago, as well as high levels of interest rate volatility due to policy and macroeconomic uncertainties. Actually, one of my colleagues at the New York Fed, Michael Fleming, in our research and statistics department, did a study that shows that while liquidity in the Treasury markets was challenged last year, the decline in liquidity was more commensurate with the increases in volatility that the market experienced at the time. I think further, the volatility in 2022 and 2023 didn't really have kind of the added challenges of heavily lopsided order flow, you know, where selling flows are far outweighing the buy orders, which was more of what the market participants faced in 2020. But while reassuring as it is that Treasury markets have functioned well, this really isn't a reason to be complacent. So it's important that market stakeholders remain vigilant, work towards improving and sustaining the liquidity and resilience of the Treasury markets. And I'm sure we'll get into more of that during the course of the discussion.
Sure. Well, that brings me to the next question. The standing repo facility and the Foreign and International Monetary Authority's repo facility that were introduced during the Dash for Cash, How will they function? Will you'll continue to maintain those, and will they dampen stress events in a future crisis?
So the reality is that these facilities act as very useful backstops. They will help mitigate future stress events and support Treasury market liquidity and resilience. They provide a temporary liquidity option for holders of Treasury securities, which really makes fire sale market dynamics of forced selling less likely under stress. When we consider the FEMA repo facility specifically, in March 2020, U.S. Treasuries held in foreign and international monetary authority accounts at the New York Fed declined by over $100 billion. Were the FEMA repo facility in effect then, it's likely that many of those sales would have, could have been avoided. Since its inception, FEMA repo was an overnight facility, but earlier this year, the FOMC approved a 7-day tenor option for FEMA repo, really to help reduce the operational and frictional challenges experienced in different time zones and jurisdictions when accessing the facility. The markets group at the New York Fed actually operates a business known as Central Bank and International Account Services. And so in that group, we provide a variety of services to foreign central banks and related institutions, including execution services and custody of their U.S. Treasury holdings. So we're really well positioned to provide seamless support around this offering. So, you know, I do think some of those measures will be really helpful if we come under stressful situations in the future.
Now, transparency in markets has been a theme since the financial crisis, and you've talked about the need to improve the quality and the availability of data in the Treasury market. Where are the gaps today, and how do you intend to plug them?
So last year, the Treasury Market Practices Group, fondly known as the TMPG, which we at the New York Fed sponsor, issued a white paper on data availability and transparency, specifically in the U.S. Treasury market. The paper identified several gaps in current practices, particularly in the uncleared bilateral repo market and the dealer-to-client cash market. There are two important initiatives currently working to close those gaps. So in June 2022, Treasury's Office of Financial Research, or OFR, as it's known, conducted a pilot data collection in the non-centrally cleared bilateral repo market that provided valuable insights into this large and opaque part of the repo market. In January 2023, OFR proposed a permanent collection of this data, and I'm hopeful that it will move ahead with doing so on a more permanent basis. Secondly, there have been ongoing improvements made in FINRA trace data on Treasury transactions that help provide more information on the dealer-to-client cash market. Since February, Trace has been providing daily aggregate data on transactions in the Treasury market, and the SEC also recently approved the release of transaction-level data on the nominal on-the-run securities. So as we learn from this careful, incremental progression towards increased transparency, I'm hopeful that there'll be movement towards increased data transparency across the Treasury universe, especially for the less liquid segments of the Treasury market, like the off-the-run market, where transparency is currently limited.
We had Professor Daryl Duffy on the podcast a couple of episodes ago, and he discussed his research that suggests a lack of dealer balance sheet capacity has been a key factor in the various Treasury market stress events. Do you agree with his outcomes? And given Treasury's issuance is expected to rise to $48 trillion by the end of 2034, just how big a problem could this be?
Having spent the majority of my career working in large financial institutions, balance sheet is not an unlimited resource, and that's just the reality. It can manifest as limitations in dealer capacity to intermediate markets at times, but with that in mind, monitoring and further study of dealer capacity is an ongoing, important, and worthwhile endeavor. Historically, though, such a dislocation was very, very rare in the Treasury market. And before 2020, one would have to go back to circa 1970 to find another time when the central bank intervened to support Treasury market liquidity and functioning. As mentioned earlier, the introduction of standing repo and the FEMA repo facilities make Treasury markets more resilient. It reduces the probability for emergency official action. And other steps towards improved resilience you know, include the planned expansion of central clearing in the treasury market. This can help mitigate stress in the market during challenging times and reduce tail risk. You know, over the years, we've seen the entrance, obviously, also of new market participants, just as they have entered other markets, such as foreign exchange and credit markets. And I think that part of the market will also continue to evolve. You know, one of the things that we didn't talk about a little bit earlier that I wanted to mention that I think is important and maybe peripheral to this specific question, but kind of measures that, you know, kind of will continue to support the markets is that the, you know, widely anticipated Treasury buyback program will be launching later this year. You know, it obviously has multiple objectives, but an important one in relation to our discussion today, Scott, is really purchases for liquidity support. My group has been working very closely with Treasury to implement this program. We will operate it on their behalf as their fiscal agent. And so this is another impact of, you know, measures to support Treasury liquidity, you know, obviously, as well as other objectives such as cash management and so forth. But I thought that that was worth just mentioning as well.
That's a good point. It's a new and different policy. So thank you for that. Sticking with Professor Duffy, he's also highlighted potential changes that could be made in the supplemental leverage ratio to increase bank balance sheet capacity. During the height of the pandemic in April of 2020, the Fed announced a temporary measure to exclude U.S. Treasury securities and deposits at Fed Reserve banks from the SLR calculation. We believe on balance sheet treasuries should be excluded on a permanent basis to free up balance sheet capacity. What are your views on this topic?
Let me set out some of the facts. Last July, Federal Reserve Vice Chair for Supervision, Barr, completed his holistic review of capital for large banks. In his summary of the review, Vice Chair Barr did not recommend changes to the calibration of the SLR. He noted that evidence about the SLR's effect on Treasury market intermediation is inconclusive. He explains that with the revisions to risk-based capital requirements that he recommended, the enhanced SLR would generally not be the binding constraint at the holding company level. He also noted that the Federal Reserve Board would carefully monitor Treasury market intermediation and consider, you know, policy responses as appropriate on an ongoing basis. You know, certain changes to bank capital rules resulting from Vice Chair Barr's review were proposed last July, and the comment period for those rules closed in January. So I think we need to watch how this evolves over time. And I think, you know, also Chair Powell has said that he expects one of the rules known as Basel III Endgame to be finalized this year. And that would include broad and material changes in response to industry comments. I think you all know that sometimes when you focus on one particular parameter, it can sort of exacerbate others. So I think this more kind of comprehensive and holistic view is probably the right way to kind of look at the overall landscape and sort of monitor on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, the clearing features around Treasury markets are important, and clearing in general. ISDA did comment on the Basel Endgame. We had the benefit of having the QIS, which was very helpful. In that, we saw with CVA charges and the G-SIB surcharge on the G-SIB banks alone, we saw an 80% increase in clearing due to capital costs. So that's problematic in and of itself. Then there's the question of whether the SLR is essentially an unhealthy tax on what is a low return, kind of low risk asset. And so we've published a letter following the Basel Endgame comment file. You can find that on our website. It's right at the top of the page. Lots of good important footnotes around Fed policy, different responses to the crisis. It's, as you say, a challenging topic and really important, but I think everybody's goal here is to make sure that we have deep liquid markets in this very important asset class, and we want to make sure that it's successful in times of crisis and in times of peace for sure. In December, the SEC adopted final rule changes that will require increased clearing of U.S. Treasury securities. Do you think the clearing of Treasuries will free up dealer balance sheet capacity? And are there any potential challenges that you see on the horizon?
I mean, I think, of course, the systematic practice of novating trades to clearing clears down balance sheet. freeing up capacity to continue servicing clients. I mean, you know, obviously we've seen that in the derivative markets as well. But I think more broadly, I believe increased clearing will help manage dealer balance sheets through improved netting, reduced settlement fails, you know, especially when markets are under stress. Also, crucially, expanded central clearing will bring about more consistency and robust risk management practices and provide the official sector with increased visibility into the clearing and settlement of the Treasury market. You know, with that in mind, this is a very important area to dedicate operational and legal resources to get the implementation right. And I know the market is very focused on that. You know, the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation, or FICC, as they're fondly known, is working on several aspects related to this new rule. You know, everything from legal and operational frameworks, customer segregation, which will obviously pave the way to facilitate cross-margining. There are a number of challenges, including legal documentation, and I'm glad to see that SIFMA is convening participants to craft new master agreements in light of the new regulations. I think that there are a lot of challenges, but I think that the industry is coming together to sort of systematically work through those. We've also heard that other organizations are considering entering the business of clearing U.S. treasuries. You know, obviously that can create a different kind of lens and perspective on how to implement the rules. So I do think that it will take some time to kind of really show its value because these things are nascent as they start up. But, you know, I believe that, you know, over time, we will see benefits to clearing as we've seen in other markets.
Yeah, I think the operational challenges you've identified are super important for market participants to pay attention to, legal documentation. And once a preferred clearing model is kind of agreed, then getting the interconnections and the hookups, segregation, if that's appropriate, really need to be a focus of market participants so they're ready in the timeframe prescribed under the rule. Now, this might be a little nuanced, but the clearing mandate covers certain cash, treasury securities, and repo transactions. Do you think the benefits are more apparent for repos, for cash securities, or both equally here?
I think both trade types benefit from what I mentioned previously. Reduced settlement flows, thus a reduction in fails, consistent risk management practices, improved official sector visibility. I think the SEC's sequence of requiring broader clearing for certain cash transactions to be implemented first is sensible. I think you have to walk before you can run. I think this order also recognizes that intermediation has evolved more in the cash market than in the repo market. And broader clearing, you know, allows for more complete management of counterparty and liquidity risks in the cash market. So there are also have been some strides in the cross-margining between cash and futures. Requiring broader cash clearing provides an incentive for further progress in this regard. So obviously, we know that there's different accounting treatment related to netting and cash versus financing markets. But I think that kind of looking at the package of clearing and the sort of sequencing of how this ramps up will set the scene for allowing these benefits to be sort of realized as things evolve.
Yeah, I think I'm going to come back to my earlier comments. We agree with clearing. Clearing is safer. We just can't figure out why the Basel Endgame would increase the cost with more capital requirements because clearing has worked. So, but that's for a different podcast. Maybe we'll get you to come back and we can debate capital policy on that one. All-to-all trading is often touted as another market structure change that could increase the resilience of treasury markets. What's needed to make this a reality, and is clearing a prerequisite to have that all-to-all trading?
All-to-all trading is an interesting topic. Staff at the New York Fed, the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and the U.S. Treasury, you know, have all published research on this issue. Theoretically, all-to-all trading can increase market liquidity and resilience if it brings more participants into a single marketplace, increasing the chance to match trades and reduce costs. I don't see clearing as a prerequisite for all-to-all trading. Broader clearing, all else equal, makes development of all-to-all platforms more likely since it unbundles kind of counterparty and execution risk. But I expect that any evolution towards all-to-all trading to be gradual. It will be several years before broader clearing is operational and perhaps years more before data transparency is fully evolved. So with broader clearing and greater transparency, arguably make all-to-all more likely to emerge, but it's just not a foregone conclusion. The intermediation in markets has really sort of proved to be the enduring model. And so I think it remains to be seen if the treasury market ecosystem will evolve in this direction. I guess beyond this, more broadly, I also note that all-to-all trading, expanded clearing, and increased transparency may support innovation in the range of trading protocols available to treasury market participants. So, you know, I think one thing we know for sure is that innovation in sort of electronic trading protocols models continues to evolve. And I think this is a space to watch. And clearing will, you know, the unbundling is definitely one of the things that could kind of create some movement in that regard.
Yeah, maybe even, as you noted before, some increased competition in the trading space or the clearing space could also bring some innovation as well. I'd like to finish by asking you about market digitization and specifically tokenization. Can you talk about the tokenization initiatives at the New York Fed and what does success look like in this space?
Oh, that's a great question. And I thank you for raising it, Scott. As you mentioned, we are exploring the potential use of tokenization and blockchain technology in finance, and that's happening via our New York Innovation Center. NYIC, as we call it, is a team within the markets group of the New York Fed. They do research and technical experimentation to generate insights around central bank innovation opportunities. Success to us really boils down to improving upon the current state. Current payment systems function effectively, but as you know, certain frictions remain, particularly around speed, cost, and accessibility. And during the settlement process, there are a number of risks that firms have to navigate, including settlement, liquidity, and counterparty risk. So we're particularly interested in what operational benefits, you know, atomic or instantaneous settlement through tokenization might be able to offer for central banks and other financial market participants. Just to talk a little bit about some of the team's work, New York Innovation Center's Project CEDAR experimented with foreign exchange spot transactions, which are often a building block in much longer cross-border wholesale transaction chains. The industry standard for settling these transactions is around 2 business days. But using simulated tokenized central bank wholesale money on a distributed ledger, the NYIC team found that it was possible to settle an FX transaction for both the sender and recipient in fewer than 10 seconds on average. So when we added in another currency as part of the second phase of Project CEDAR in collaboration with the Monetary Authority of Singapore, the settlement time rose to an average of under 30 seconds. But again, this was well under the current industry standards of 2 days. So, you know, very encouraging. And now that we have many more questions to explore around interoperability and scalability in particular, but these preliminary results and the technology itself are really quite promising. So we look forward to continuing to explore its potential through our research. And lastly, I'll note that for this audience, the NYIC publishes its technical research as a contribution to the public dialogue overall. So if this topic is of further interest to any of your listeners, I would welcome you to explore our work deeper through our public reports. And you can find those on the New York Fed's website.
Terrific. Thank you. I think it's important to have policy makers, policy leaders engage in this technology evolution. Really important. Finally, I'd like to ask a little bit more about you. You've had a fascinating career in financial services, working at the Royal Bank of Scotland, Nomura, Deutsche Bank, BNY Mellon, and RBC Capital Markets before moving to the New York Fed. What brought you to financial services in the first place, and what do you like most about it?
You know, I've always been very interested in finance. I studied finance. That's how I pursued my higher education. You know, I've been really lucky to have a career that has evolved from, I would say, some quite specific, you know, I always call my originating DNA. It is really kind of businesses that are fundamentally about commercializing themselves around evolving market structure, evolving regulation, and digitization. And having been supported and sponsored to kind of support those types of initiatives in the earlier parts of my career in the firms that I've worked for, I've continued to kind of carry those with me as a focus and something that I'm committed to always kind of thinking about at the forefront of kind of the activities that I personally undertake. And that has just led me to advancing opportunities in different roles across different institutions. And it's just been a very exciting journey. I kind of always say that in the roles that I've done, either no one's done it before or no one's done it in quite the same way before. And so, you know, I just feel really grateful to people that have supported me and have felt that the kind of the lens that I look at the businesses through as being kind of really important to how to, you know, think about ensuring they sort of stay ahead of those kind of market structure dynamics, obviously, as the market sort of evolves. So far, it's been a really great ride. And, you know, I'm in a super interesting seat, which again, I'm very kind of humbled to be able to serve and really kind of continue to kind of pursue interesting work, but also, you know, kind of give back at the same time through some of the, you know, critical financial and public policy issues that we look at here at the New York Fed. So, you know, it's great. And I love waking up every day to do what I do. So it's such energy for me. I guess that's what I'd say.
Michelle, it's been great chatting with you. We're out of time, but I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. And it was a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Scott, we've now had the regulator view. We previously had the market participant view, and we've had the views of an academic. Everyone's coming at this from slightly different angles, as might be expected, but there's actually quite a clear consensus that having a stable, liquid, resilient treasury market is absolutely critical to global markets. There's obviously some difference of opinion on how that might be achieved. And in your discussion, you touched on changes that should be made to the supplementary leverage ratio. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. The SLR is a non-risk sensitive binding constraint on banks that can impede their ability to act as intermediaries, including their capacity to clear for clients, particularly in times of stress. During the March 2020 dash for cash, the Federal Reserve took emergency action to temporarily exclude U.S. Treasury securities from the SLR calculation to give banks greater capacity to expand their balance sheet and provide liquidity. We think a permanent exclusion would be better to promote the resilience of the U.S. Treasury market and give banks more certainty to expand balance sheet capacity than a temporary regime introduced during market stress that will later be reversed. Academics have also pointed out to the role of the SLR in constraining the ability of banks to participate in the U.S. Treasury market in certain circumstances, so we think a move is justified here. In March, we sent a letter to U.S. prudential regulators asking for permanent exclusion and will continue to engage with policymakers on this issue. In light of the SEC's final rules to mandate clearing for treasuries, we also struggle with the idea that increased capital requirements on treasury clearing or all clearing is an appropriate policy outcome. The fact is, clearing in swaps has worked really very well since its reform, and adding to the cost of this is going to make it more expensive, and we think goes the wrong way in terms of market liquidity. And we think that the clearing has functioned appropriately so and doesn't require additional capital charges, and we want to make sure that it continues to function as effectively as it has over the past 8 years.
Okay, all sounds very interesting. As with all of these, the letters and materials we discuss on this podcast, you can read them in full by going onto the ISDA website, isda.org. Now, by the time you listen to this, we'll likely be days away from the ISDA AGM in Tokyo on April 16th to 18th. So this is my last chance to direct you to our AGM website, agm.isda.org, where you can register to attend. I very much hope to see you there for some swaps and, who knows, possibly some sushi as well. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to The Swap. Keep in touch with ISDA via our website, www.isda.org, and our social media channels. See you next time.